I'll start these things the same way. So, can you say your name and spell it for me?
Yes, my name is Yatasha Womack. Yatasha Lene Womack, actually, but Yatasha, YTASHA Womack, WOM as in Mary, ACK.
Okay. Do I have any permission to record this for oral history archive called Voices of the
We
Black Imaginary?
Yes, you do.
And are you aware that this recording will be available to the public and might be used by students and the public to learn about Afrofuturism?
Yes, I do.
Okay. All right. Well, obviously, my name is Julie Chavlis. It's May 4th, 2023, and this is a Zoom interview with Yatasha Womack. So I'm going to start with like the super basics. Where were you born and where did you go to school?
Well, I was born in Chicago, a proud Southsider, and I went to elementary school and high school in Chicago, and then went to college, undergrad at Clark Atlanta University, and then on to grad school at Columbia College in Chicago.
Right, and at Clark Atlanta, you studied mass media.
Yes, I was a mass media arts major with a concentration in journalism. I was there in the 90s and mid 90s, so it was an exciting arc of things. There was a lot of preparation for the Atlanta Olympics program, so I was part of their Atlanta Olympic Broadcasting entity trained students, and they trained them out of Clark Atlanta, so I got to work in the Olympics in Atlanta. And as a result, I was, at the time, this is before internet really takes off, journalism was a focus in print media. So, but because I was a part of this Atlanta Olympic Broadcasting training program, I took a lot of TV, film, and radio courses.
Okay. And I just sort of emphasize Clark Atlanta is a historically black educational institution, what we call it, HBCU.
Yes, it is.
And you were there in what is, a very important sort of black cultural center in Atlanta, Georgia. And you were there during like a really sort of pivotal moment in the city's history because, like, one of the arguments is that that really, as many Olympic activities do, really transform the municipality, right? Because they have to build so much and organize so much to welcome so many people.
Right.
And so from your perspective, what were some of the, like you say, like, you part of your educational experience was shaped by that, but like in terms of like living in a community at that time, what were some of the things that stood out for you?
Well, in addition to all this preparation around the Olympics, there were also a lot of record labels that were based in Atlanta. And part of their promotions was to have a college wing. So, whether it was, LaFace or Bad Boy, they were based in New York, but all the major ones had departments down there. But yeah, you had LaFace, you had Rowdy Records, you had So So Def, and they all had a wing of college interns whose job it was to get college students to come to events. So, because I'm in mass comm, those interns were mass communications majors. So, in addition to just the general Atlanta scene, I was at a lot of industry events coming up as a college student. And the reality was Atlanta was such a destination at that point in time for people who were emerging in film and film and music, TV especially, comedy. So, you go out to what you think are college parties, and there's a lot of celebrities there as well. So
So
it
is
was a
this,
big mix.
so was this when your emphasis on dance was also developing?
No, my emphasis on dance actually began in Chicago.
Okay.
I was attending Mayfair Academy from the age of 6 on to the time I graduated from high school, taking tap, ballet, tap most consistently. I took tap every year, but I was doing ballet or jazz or modern. And then I also was part of the dance program at Whitney Young High School. So they were, in addition to kind of this academic center, they were also a performing arts school. And so I was doing modern or I guess they weren't quite calling it contemporary yet. They were still talking about modern. And you know, that was captain of my pom-pom team, my cheer pom squad. So I did all of the you know, I was we were in national city championships, you know, state competitions. Once we got to the we were a majority, we were all, you know, students of color on the pom-pom team, generally, you know, mostly Black, Latina, and Asian. And so we anyway, so that became unique when you get in the state and national level. But yeah, I mean, I was all, voted All-American pom-pom girl. There's a whole competition. I can tell you a lot about my pom-pom life. And that's my cheerleading for humanity. But yeah, just coming up, I grew up, dance was a big part of my life. My family, they were really into social dancers. Chicago was big on stepping. House music was big. So the way you dance to house versus the way you dance to hip hop were all things that were very, I was very conscious of. And when you're you know, a teen, you know, coming up through dance, you're also choreographing a lot, you know, especially if you're doing things for your school, you know, so you're always making up these dances. That's a part of it. And then college, I continued dance in part doing some things through like the cheer arena for basketball games my first 2 years, but mostly you know, because I was a mass comm major, a lot of my dance really shifted to the house music scene at the time. And Atlanta was such a juggernaut because you had students from everywhere. They would play everybody's music. So they're playing, you know, the Miami bass, and they're playing the, you know, DC go-go. They're playing some Chicago house, a little Detroit techno, a little New Orleans, you know, all these. And there were a lot of hip-hop variations that weren't quote-unquote mainstream that were hyper-regional that they would play as well. So it's this cacophony of musical experiences, you know, where you get to hear what students all over are thinking about. And then I also grew up in metaphysics through kind of a New Thought philosophy. And that came out of a church that was led by, you know, Reverend Johnny Coleman. She's like this pioneer in New Thought and metaphysics and so forth. So I was sort of third generation in that. And there's a lot of emphasis on the imagination. Right, a lot of conversation about how you sort of anchor that in your life. So for me, you know, I grew up in an environment where art and music and thinking about futures and Black history was central. But because my parents were in government and education, there was also like this real relationship to human rights. And you know, all people having, you know, of course, human rights and advocating for that and being very multicultural. Yeah, so by the time I, you know, went to Clark Atlanta, you know, I was sort of poised around this idea of what we would eventually call Afrofuturism. You know, a lot of the campus life was people talking about what we call Afrofuturism today, or what they were starting to call Afrofuturism at the time, but many of the students weren't aware of it. There was a guy who put together a paper, kind of this like student journal that was all Afrofuturist work. I think that's the first time I saw the essay Black to the Future. They sort of reprinted it in like the student journal. And I wrote for a lot of publications, interned with a lot of media spaces when I was in college. So, which wound up being good since so much of that converged as
So,
the internet came to be.
it's interesting. I think one of the things we're always curious about, the home life of people who are involved in, where do they come from? How did they get here? So you mentioned that your parents were in government and
Well, my dad worked for the Department of Health and Human Services.
okay.
You know, my mom was a lifelong educator, moving from teacher to principal to the executive
Okay.
realms, higher administration levels in the
Okay.
city.
All right. And so there's a public policy element that you're always aware of
Right.
in your work. Okay.
Right.
And as you're sort of graduating, like you're the period that you're in college is actually like, a very fertile period for Afrofuturism. You're a writer, and I know that you did a column for Chicago Defender. You wrote for Upscale magazine.
Right.
When you were writing those things, were you reporting on that culture that you were in? Were you sort of thinking about the Black experience and sort of documenting the artistic things that you were seeing?
Yeah, very much so. You know, one of the things I became really aware of early on was how the world I was a part of was not always reflected in the media that I was watching. So much so that I necessarily expected, or at least knew that I was going to have to read a lot of books and really dig deep to find things that spoke to the world I was familiar with. And at some point, you know, when I was a senior in college, I kind of had what I thought was a career crisis. You know, I wanted to be the scientist, and then I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a scientist. And eventually, then I was like, oh, an architect. And I took this career test that said I should be a journalist. And I was like, a journalist. And there was a student in my class, Robert Bledsoe, and he was a student reporter for the Chicago Defender as a senior in high school. And he told me, he was like, oh, all you have to do is come down on Saturdays. They have classes, you know, and you can start writing for the paper. I was like, what? So that's exactly what I did as a and this is in high school, mind you, right? They had like a teen section of the paper. So the managing editor of the paper, every Saturday, he spent 3 hours sort of training students on how to be journalists. My friend who brought me in, he was a little further along, so they were already writing for the paper, but we spent months learning things that a lot of students learn their freshman, sophomore year of college. So by the time I went to Clark, Atlanta, I was able to start writing for the school paper right away. And I was very kind of clear, you know, the Chicago Defender is one of the oldest Black newspapers, and at the time was a daily newspaper. So there's very much a focus on, in part being mission oriented, but writing the story that other people aren't writing and how to ask the questions. So I came into HBCU just very like journalist minded, you know, doing these stories. And I mean, I started writing my first semester of freshman year, which is not usually how your writing career evolves in college. I went on to edit the school yearbook, and was interning at the, where did I intern? I was writing for the Atlanta Tribune, which was a Black business publication while I was a student in college. I started doing things with Upscale magazine while I was a student. I interned with Emerge magazine, the Black news magazine in DC, the same year that I worked in the Olympics. So I was like on a mission, you know, trying to like learn as much as I could. And I feel really grateful because I met a lot of professionals who are now sort of like legendary in these spaces. And I'm like the kid in the room. So a lot of my life was being the kid in the room. Even when I worked at the Defender, it literally was an outgrowth of me. I graduated from school. I was supposed to have a job in Atlanta. It didn't work out. Came back to Chicago. And I started working at a bookstore while I was applying for jobs. And the first magazine I worked for kind of fell apart. You know, I'd just been there a few months. They imploded. I was really sad. And I said, well, I'm going to go to grad school, or I'm moving to California, or I'm getting a new job. And I wound up getting the Chicago Defender, And I said, hey, I wrote these articles for this paper. Can I print them here? And they said, hey, you want a job? And I said, yeah. And it was kind of a different crop of people. So they didn't remember me as the student journalist. And they were like, yeah, sure. You want to work here? No problem. And I just started right away. And we had to do two stories a day, which is unheard of at a daily paper. But it really got me cultivated around mining for stories, looking for the story that people aren't writing about. And when you're looking at Black culture, there's a lot of stories people aren't writing about. So there was a lot to write. And that, I think, sort of honed me into, at first I'm just, doing general news reporting. They had me do business stories, and at some point shifted into writing about arts and culture. Which is really what I wanted to write about, in part because I was immersed in so much culture in college. And I got to see, I remember seeing Vibe magazine when it debuted. I think it might have even been in our freshman year goodie bag. And I remember thinking, and it was like Snoop was on the cover. And I remember thinking, oh my God, you can write about music and your life and your culture, like as a person of color. I don't have to. Because sometimes you read writing and so much of the writing is outside your world, right? I mean, as a kid, a teen, a lot of things outside of your world. And I was thinking, man, I'm going to have to read all of the Greek myths, all of the Roman mythology, so I could cross-reference it with my life and these things happening. And when I saw that I could also write about my experiences, like how I thought about music or culture or my life, I was like, what? I mean, it was like a whole new world opened up for me. And so I really thought about that deal, and I admired a lot of those writers who were writing for those publications at the time, Greg Tate and Michael Gonzalez. I mean, they were like my heroes because I'm looking at these people writing about culture and really capturing it in a way that was really sophisticated. So that was my mindset working at the Defender. And I wrote about a lot. I there's people who think I still write for the Defender today. That's how much I wrote for them on a local level. I mean, there were people telling me like, wow, I've been working in this industry for 20 years. No one's ever interviewed me. Or I've ran this business. No one ever profiled me before. There's a guy named George Daniels. He's very popular for having, record stores for several decades in Chicago and doing a lot of kind of community-centric businesses around the music industry. Kind of played like a father figure to people who are trying to get into the music industry. He told me I was the first person who ever wrote about him. And he was not at the beginning of his career when I was writing about him, right? So that's the sort of relationships or experiences I find myself having at a really early on, where I'm writing about people and places that other people aren't writing about. And I had a publication that I could do that sort of writing with.
Yeah, so I think that's really helpful because I think your first major book was Post Black, which
Well,
was
there
a
was one before that, actually.
oh wow, okay.
It was
What was
called, I
that?
co-edited it, and it was called Beats, Rhymes, and Life: What We Love and Hate About Hip Hop. It came out in 2007.
Oh wow, okay. I did not know that. Okay. All
That
right.
was in my music industry, music journalism life.
Well, it always struck me that Post Black, at least in the description, really was capturing a kind of cultural moment. I mean, the sort of subtitle is like, how generations redefine African American identity, and sort of thinking about the background in education that you had, seems like you really sort of tapped into these dominant strands of the 90s and early 2000s, really where African Americans are really asking really important questions about blackness, really thinking about trying to recontextualize things. And it seems like post-black might have brought together a lot of the trends in your columns and writings. And where did you get the idea, like, hey, this could be a book? Because I think, you know, it's one thing to write, you know, be a reporter. It's a totally different thing to write a book, right? Like, a book is a different thing.
It was a shift. And what's funny is I thought I was focusing more on how to make a shift into doing more in film and TV than I was consciously around writing books, which is sort of interesting. So before that book came out, I worked on a Tupac documentary, Before I Wake. I've done started working I started doing work on a film called Love Shorts. You know, it was kind of this romantic comedy film. And so it was, but you know, I was in so many spaces writing for so many people, right? So after The Defender, I'm writing for like I was an editor at large for Upscale, wrote for Envy magazine, this black business magazine. So I'm in and did some stuff for Vibe and Essence too. But I was in so many different spaces that were black cultural spaces that I could see the gaps. So one morning, you know, I could be covering, say, these senior business leaders who are very community centric, who just happen to say things like, kids aren't listening to jazz anymore. And then in the evening, I'm like interviewing, you know, new jazz artists who are in their 20s. And I would tell them, I was like, no, really, I'm going to be interviewing some people who are doing jazz. And they're like, ah, that doesn't exist. Or I'm, you know, interviewing the people, young people who are emerging jazz artists. And they're like, oh, black businesses don't support jazz. And you're like, no, really, I literally was just talking to some people. So there are these gaps that I would always see. And, those gaps became opportunities to see relationships. Because, you know, even interculturally, sometimes people stay in their own circles and, you know, don't always see the relationship between a thing because they're not hopping around in the same way that I was. So, what I didn't realize, because as a journalist, you sort of have this eye for trends and new things happening, which becomes the basis for your story. Somewhere between that, seeing the gaps, you know, lent itself to me always having these questions of how come people don't see these things. And maybe some people would use that as a business opportunity, right? You create a business and service people to make the connections. But I think for me, I saw it as people not seeing the connections as potentially undermining the community, organizations kind of imploding because they're not aware of trends or not engaging the internet like they should, or the, you know, the opposite, you know, people are really into trends, but they're not connected to the history that people are, you know. So anyway, so at some point, you know, I did the Beats, Rhymes, and Life book, which I co-edited with Kenji Jasper. And after that, I was started thinking, you know, someone said, oh, hey, I met this editor. She's looking for new writers. And I said, oh, I have a book idea. Great. And that's where the Post Black book came because it was so on my mind. You know, I was having issues even with pitching sometimes because they would say, Black people aren't into this, or who is your audience, or which Black people are into this? I had an editor call me in once. Because I was writing an article about people who had HIV and these free Reiki classes that were available. And he just came to me. He's like, Black people don't even know what Reiki is. And I was like, well, that's why I'm writing the article. So that they can take the free class. Maybe they want to, that would be very helpful for people. But so all of that, you know, by the time I was approached about, hey, do you have any ideas? I was like, oh, absolutely. You know, it's there's these are all the things that when I bring it up, people want to say, what does that have to do with Black people? And that's how the post-Black book evolved.
Right.
And
And
again, it wasn't about the end of Blackness, but sort of a shift in culture, which ultimately sort of lined up with Barack Obama becoming president.
right. Right. And yeah, I'm struck by the fact that some of the things that you're writing about, some of the things you're experiencing are very, very Afrofuturist. And the terminology around that is sort of developing at the same time you're doing it, right? Like the words floating around, like people are doing stuff. It's all in the same world. And so obviously the book that, I think a lot of people would associate with you with in relation to Afrofuturism is called Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture, which comes out in a long, long time ago, like 2013, which isn't that long ago. But when in the Afrofuturist term, it's a long, long time ago because things change so fast. So it's 10 years. Like this is like your anniversary year.
I know I probably should have stopped and done some. Well, I guess technically the celebration would be coming up, but
Yeah.
it's been such an evolution since then,
Right. Yeah, it's another
that
edition. You can pop out another edition pretty
right. Well,
easily.
I have a follow-up that's coming up. I do have a follow-up that'll be out, but yeah, I mean, as soon as the book came out,
So, how
immediately
did
it
you
was about
decide to write that
contextualizing.
book? Right. So, like, how did you say, okay, you finished Post Black, and that got out in the world? What was the reaction to that book? Like, was that book popular for you? From your perspective, was Post Black like a success? Was like, okay, now I'm gonna write books. No more of this magazine stuff. It's only long form for me. Like, how did it go?
No, it wasn't. No, actually. It's so funny because a lot of things happen at the same time, right? And so your perspective on that is really just your point of awareness in the moment. You know, the look back, there's a lot of clarity. In the moment, it's like these kind of floating spheres, and you navigating or finding a direction and moving towards it. But when I think about Post Black, I wrote the book, and because I did so much. You know, at the time I wrote Post Black, there was a lot of intergenerational challenges in around organizations, around media, between sort of this Gen X millennial versus boomers, right? And of course, you had a lot of boomers who were very supportive and nurturing and, you know, giving advice, all of that. But there was this constant narrative of like Gen X having just failed society, you know, and being these you know miscreants who couldn't seem to do anything but create rap music and pull down the civil rights movement. Yeah, I mean that seemed to be the tonality that you guys are doing nothing, you've learned nothing, and not progressing. And I was always the one, but look, you know. And trying to show the rainbow in the sky. And so, you know, Post Black was a part, a statement of, look, we exist. You know, these people who are building on the movements of the past, we exist. And also, these are valid spaces. You have people who are queer and open about it. You have people who are not Christian or Muslim in the traditional sense and are practicing a host of other religions, or no religion at all, or you know, or they're spiritual. You have people who are, and all these other categories. You have an educated population. That used to be a big argument, you know, where people are like, oh, people aren't going to college. And you're like, wait a second, there are people going to college. Like, and you know, not it's a lot of people who are on the up and up and but there was like this kind of intra, I don't know, it's like a, I don't want to call it a culture war, but something like that. Around a, well, culture war gets so skewed now, so throw that out the window. Forget the culture war. I'll just say there were a lot of generational tensions. And I, for me, it manifested sometimes in what I could pitch, depending on where I was, right? And then it also manifested in me working with some organizations that were very anti-change and anti-embracing things that they associate younger people with. So sometimes it's not just the younger people themselves, it's just that They might be more familiar with certain elements that are changing in a population that's like, well, how do I maintain control? If this person's talking about this new thing, and it's like, oh, you ignore the new thing by getting rid of these people. So I dealt with some very up close and personal attempts at undermining organizational growth. And it was all done under the guise of the young people taking over, the young people not knowing what they're doing, when it's like, it's not about young people. There's a lot of people here who are looking to build and grow. And some people are, bringing those experiences with them. So post-Black was really a manifestation of that. And I think I even have a chapter in there about the generations, where I kind of break that down, symbolically, because again, I dealt with so much of it. But going from there to post-Black, I mean, going from post-Black rather to Afrofuturism, I mean, I was sort of thinking about what I would like to write next. And I met a woman who told me she was teaching Afrofuturism and on a college level. And I said, well, what's that? And then she explained it. I'm like, well, wait a second. Me and all my friends were into that. I know a lot of artists and creatives, they're into Afrofuturism. Nobody's using this term. I've written for all these Black publications. I'm, at the poetry events and the jazz and the neo soul and the hip hop. Nobody has ever used this word. I was like, where's this word coming from? And because I knew so many people who have been outliers or thought of themselves as the outliers, because hip hop, a certain kind of hip hop or a certain kind of R&B was so dominant. And if you creatively didn't fall within that parameter or anchor yourself to it, as a creative, you could, I mean, it could seem like you were just putting a stopgap on your career, or that there was no place to really showcase and grow and blossom. And all of this is, again, as you're moving through Napster, you're moving through before, as you're starting to get into social media. I mean, once streaming and social media, really sunk in, all of that changed. But those years before that, it was really rough for a lot of artists who were not traditionalist or were not the flavor of the month, so to speak, right? And and I was just hyper aware that Afrofuturism to me described a lot of those artists, artists I knew who were into Black rock or who were doing jazz and the lineage of Sun Ra, neo soul that was a little left of the more the neo soul we were hearing on the radio. All of that were like these really valid and important creative spaces. So when I heard the term and I interviewed the woman and I wrote about it on my blog, and I said, "Yeah, I'm going to write a book about this," because I was upset that I hadn't heard the term. Yeah, and I just thought about all these people I knew who, if they had known that term, they could have maybe thought of themselves as theorists, even, or maybe they could have found, the Afrofuturism listserv that Alondra Nelson put together, and it could have, helped them to find some grounding to their work. Because, I mean, artists are going to find a way in some respect because they're constantly creating. But if you're more of a theorist and you're working with Afrofuturism and it doesn't have a term, how do you build from that? Maybe you don't even know what a theorist is, and you're finding connections between quantum physics and music metrics, and it's like, where do you write that? Who do you talk to when you find people to talk to? How do you build on that idea? So, me having met so many people in that space, many of whom I knew in Atlanta, where a lot of those ideas of Afrofuturism gelled for me, I said, I'm going to write a book about this. And
So,
yeah, I pitched it and went from there.
when you were planning the book, and how did you know, like, how did the structure of the book come together, right? Because I think one of the things about it that makes it so effective is that it is sort of written as a personalized journey, like it's sort of you exploring Afrofuturism, but it also kind of works as like a roadmap to like the vastness of what it is, right? And so how did you, was it like a giant board and like lines? Okay, I gotta get here. I gotta, how did you design, how design that book?
Oh, well, again, this is going back to the gap concepts, right?
Okay.
Of who's talking to who. So, people who knew Afrofuturism from a jazz perspective didn't know about hip hop. People who knew, who talked about it from a hip hop perspective didn't know Sun Ra. People who knew Sun Ra didn't necessarily know about the comics. People who knew the comics didn't know about
Right.
the literature. People who knew about the literature didn't know about, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I just literally broke it down from, okay, we're going to talk about different ways you can approach it, but it's all moving to a center, as opposed to feeling like you're just sort of fragmented in these, isolated spaces, thinking about those ideas. And then also, those people, they're not really into sci-fi at all. They're just into equality and human rights and social justice and thinking about futures. And they too can be a part of Afrofuturism and thinking. Just find some of this work fascinating. Maybe it informs their work, et cetera. I think it, so initially, after kind of writing the blog entry, there was a colleague from France who came out to meet me because he was writing about Parliament Funkadelic and also studying funk music. And he, and all of this helped me formulate. This is before I said, and I am writing the book on Afrofuturism. But the discussions, it sort of struck me that he was trying to understand funk from a perspective of a lived experience. And it's a lived experience from hearing the music so much. I mean, I could sit and talk about space tropes and symbolism just off the top of my head, in a way that someone maybe who didn't grow up with, who didn't have the cultural context, couldn't, they could kind of see that relationship, but they didn't know how to explain it. And that's when it started clicking for me that there's kind of a philosophy going on. Another person who I talked to early on was John Jennings. John was doing, I think, one of his first comics exhibits, the one that was going to Japan. I was introduced to him and I said, hey, have you heard this term Afrofuturism? And he said, oh, yeah, And he started naming artists and, he started talking about Sun Ra. And Deltron 3030, and Sun Ra's name kept coming up, and I said I had not heard people really mention his name, so I started doing some research on him, and said, why are people not mentioning this man's name? I mean, I hear all the other greats, I'm not hearing Sun Ra, and so a juxtaposition of those moments just led me to say, you know what? I'm going to write a book about this because it's a lot of people like me who are familiar with these ideas, but don't realize there's so much coming from other perspectives. But as I wrote that, started writing the book, and I have to give a lot of credit to the Chicago Review Press, Lawrence Hill Books, for just saying, taking it, pitching it, and really being open to working with new writers, because a lot of publishers weren't open to new writers, certainly weren't open to new Black writers, and weren't open to new Black writers talking about history, theory, and futures, right? So I have to thank them for being so receptive to that. But as I started writing the book, it became really, I started getting ideas for stories. And it became a creative genesis for me, just doing the research, trying to write these chapters, for the book. At some point, I'm getting story ideas and I'm seeing, wait, I'm not just writing about this and tangentially connected to it and able to understand it. I'm an Afrofuturist. Yeah, I'm also an artist, if I didn't know, I'm not just a journalist. I'm writing all these films and dancing, and it's like, hey, you're an interdisciplinary artist. I was like, what? But thinking of myself that way only made sense through the lens of Afrofuturism, because I'm writing about how people approach it from different ways. And then that, once I accepted I was an artist, I'm an Afrofuturist, and I got to have this whole experience writing the Rayla book in the midst of trying to write, the Afrofuturism book, I saw, wait, there's a relationship between this creative evolution and contemplating these ideas. And so even if your creative outlet isn't necessarily something you're going to sell, just that experimentation becomes a kind of practice that aligns you with the theory and the thoughts and the ideas. So for me, all of that sort of clicked. And so by the time the Afrofuturism book came out, I felt very connected to the subject. I felt very connected to people who were interested in the subject and those who were sort of looking for it but didn't know they could find these ideas from an African diasporic space.
Okay. And that's really interesting. I think, obviously that book is often cited as the gateway for a lot of people because it was one that it's so accessible. I think a lot of the things that are written about futurism weren't quite as accessible up to that point. They were very theoretical. Not to say that I mean, there's a lot of theorists in your book, right? Like you interview a lot of people, but that was very accessible. So, like, once that book came out, it seems like you're on the road, 50 weeks out of the year talking about Afrofuturism, and you're, lecturing all over the world about Afrofuturism. So, when the book comes out, when do you start to understand that, okay, this thing that has been a part of my life for so very long is now becoming like a kind of global phenomenon. How does that transition? How do you experience that from your perspective, right? Because clearly Afrofuturism has exploded like every year after that. I mean, it like gets a little bit bigger. It's like the TARDIS, like it's bigger on the inside. Like there's a new room every day. I mean, like there's a new conference. There's a thing. There's a thing. There's a thing. There's a thing. And like I recognize this from my own perspective. Like, oh yeah, I was at Planet D South, but you couldn't get all those people to the same place again. Like, you just wouldn't be. It would just be so much more complicated because they're all everywhere now. And so it's like, huh, wow, like. We should have took a picture, and we did take a picture actually. But how were you experiencing that transformation, like just from your perspective?
Great question. I might still be processing it, to be honest with you,
Okay.
because when you're at the heart of something, or near the center of something, right? Well, I don't want to talk like I'm talking about somebody else. I'm talking about myself here. What I was very aware of, well, let me thank Columbia College because I went to Columbia College for arts, entertainment, and media management, Columbia College in Chicago.
Okay.
And I
For a
was thinking,
master's degree or
right. And
okay.
I was thinking of it more in pursuit of, how to work with artists or how to understand film and media, or if I had my own magazine. But there was so much changing at the time. It really was sort of preparing me for how to connect with audiences, just generally speaking, that may or may not be quantified. So, sometimes one of the bigger issues you would could have, maybe not so much now, but certainly in the past, was you have a project, they wouldn't feel like there's enough critical mass to support it, or there wasn't a framework for a plug and play framework for how to reach this audience, right? So maybe there was a plug and play framework on how to meet, say, an R&B audience who liked someone like Mary J. Blige, but not a plug and play one to reach an artist who was maybe a little more a black rock artist, right? Who liked to play the flute. It's not to say there aren't people who want to do it. It's just to say they don't have a plug and play way. And if you didn't have a plug and play way, you know, like a sponsorship you could automatically bring in, an audience you can point to, a publication that reached them, then people like to act like that audience either didn't exist or they didn't matter or the money you could make from them wasn't enough. So the challenge of your arts manager, as I understood, as I was sort of taught, was you find the audience. You know, if you know who the audience is, then you find ways to connect with the audience. You don't have to rely on these other structures. You sort of, you know, you find ways to connect with them. And I got to test that out in various ways with certain indie films I was doing, and so by the time, you know, I got to the point of, and I got to experiment with that doing the post Black Book. You know, I remember doing post Black saying, all right, the only way this is going to work, I couldn't even get people to endorse the book who were like notables who wrote about Black thought at the time. I mean, not that I reached out to all of them. I'm sure some of them would have, but it was more of a who are you and why would I lie? You know, there's this weird thing, right? And so I knew not to rely on that. If you know who your audience is, you assert, you connect with them, and you don't have to go through all these weird filters. So when I did the post Black Book, I said, all right, I'm going to do five parties. No, I said, I'm going to do four parties in four different cities. And partner with different entities I know there and do book signing. And whatever happens after that is what's going to happen because I can do the four on a shoestring. Somebody, something else is going to have to kick in after that. You know, so there was an aspect that I was sort of trained around thinking about connecting your work with audiences who maybe other people didn't value in the same way or did not monetize or whatever. And that helped with the Afrofuturism book. It helped with when I wrote the Rayla book in the midst of it, because I was going to these, I started going to comic book conventions. I started going to certain spaces, and this, maybe I'm not answering your question at all. I think what I'm starting to say is I was in a mind frame of knowing that there was an audience, and I kind of knew who that audience was. And they were audiences who people didn't always group together, you know, but certainly audiences, and they were global. They might not reach a critical mass and that all of them are sitting in the same space, but, you know, there's people who really love jazz of all walks of life who find Afrofuturism interesting because it gives more context to it. Yeah, you know, that sort of thing. So
So
as I started, yeah.
it seems like well, you did answer the question. It's just what it seems like is once you have the book, what you were able to do is sort of recognize that the that ecosystem of thought and action that is Afrofuturism exists. And so you sort of tapped into it through just sort of showing up at places where those people might cross over, like a comic book convention, which actually makes a lot of sense to me. Because most people don't go to comic book conventions. If you go to comic book convention, you realize like they do everything there. They show films. There are bands. There are people doing performance art. I mean, like it's everything is happening there. But yeah, it's a comic book convention, and that's why San Diego is such a huge media event, right? Because like every media you can imagine is in within spitting distance of that during that thing. And though there are a lot of those that are happening. So if you show up and say, I see you, there are a lot of people like, oh, yeah, I want to read that book, right? I could totally see that. But I also think that there's an element here that's really interesting because as a writer, you're sort of chronicling the events that are chronicling culture, but you also seem to have sort of, for lack of a better lack of a better terminology, crossed over into a thinker, right? Like you are defining what Afrofuturism is for a lot of people. Like you're being asked, like, hey, can you explain the movement? And can you talk a little bit about that transition from your perspective, right?
It was I guess I could say it was seamless on in one sense, but certainly I didn't go into Afrofuturism thinking that way. I thought what I always put at the forefront were the audiences of people who connected with these ideas and finding ways to connect it with them, right? So that they didn't feel it was so highbrow. It's like, no, you're already thinking these thoughts. You've thought about this stuff before. It's just a new term, you know, and the term means this, you know, and then giving them like quantifiable examples to be like, oh, they're like, oh, wait a second. So they're like, I'm a part of this. And you're like, yeah, you're a part of it. So for me, it was all about, you know, again, I'm thinking about people I knew in college and elsewhere who are really into this stuff and were at the margins and who felt like they're at the margins, right? So my thing is, no, you're at the center of something and you just didn't know it. I can't tell you how many people can would come up to me and say things like, wow, I always thought these thoughts. I just never wanted to tell anybody. Right. Or I didn't think, you know, like, wait, I could talk about this now, or wait, that art I did that I put in the box and said no one will like it, like there's a place for it now. You've got to be kidding me. So those are, you know, that's one level of an experience where you're like, oh no, this is a space that you're part of, and assuming they are, because you align with some of these ideas and you're building towards futures, right? So I thought more about other people than I was thinking about myself. But the more you make those connections for other people, it does sort of seamlessly put me in a space where I'm sort of thinking about these ideas and how to explain it to people. And then, as you know, so it's a little surprising, because I don't think I wasn't, you know, I know some people who are always thinking a lot about how to centralize themselves as artists and be stars and pushback. It's for me, it wasn't so much about me. I mean, it's about me to the point that you want to create and express, but it's about people understanding the ideas and them creating and thinking about them, or on a very simple level, feeling like they could have agency in their future. Like that's sort of a bottom liner, right? And so when, yeah, I mean, spaces and you know, that it's sort of a fatalism chic to act like there's no future, right? And you know, you have people who really are hanging on to these ideas that inform them, you know. I mean, thinking about futures was very important to our culture, a lot of cultures looking to move forward. And so to me, that kind of work is very meaningful. You know, when you're able to get some people to think about futures or see their relationship to it, I don't know. So that's I feel like I'm not answering your question at all, but
Right. Well,
I
I
wasn't
mean,
conscious of being that, but I was presented with opportunities to do more writing and exploring. Maybe
Well,
that's it.
yeah, there's no wrong answers. It's your life, so
No,
what you
there
can't.
is an answer. We must get to the bottom of this.
This isn't an investigative journalistic thing. It's more like, how do you remember it? Like,
No, I mean, I just
it's.
remember being a student and I would, you know, listen to people like, how did you get to work for the New York Times? And then they give you some random thing that happened. And you're like, how's that supposed to happen? Like, how am I supposed to get to that point? But
How am I supposed to
I
get,
think
how am
it's,
I supposed to do it?
yeah, I'm not supposed to duplicate that, but I think it's about open and being open and receptive to a certain kind of journey while you're also being like very focused on something that's passionate, that you're passionate about, that really helps people too.
That's fair. I think one of the things that it's really interesting about your work in Afrofuturism is that you have a definition for Afrofuturism that's very easy for people to follow. And I say that because like I every year I teach a class on futurism. I'm one of those people that uses your book, right? And I make them read a lot of different definitions of futurism, and university students like, well, I understand that definition of futurism. I understand the definition of futurism. It's not to say that the other definitions they don't understand, but the other definitions, like say Kojo Asuhun when he's writing about it and further consideration of futurism, or Alondra Nelson when she's describing language, like it just gives a little bit more. It's always a little bit more systems oriented. I don't know. It's complicated for students sometimes to parse it out, and your ability to sort of describe it in a more what I would think of concept inclusive manner. Also, there's a lot. And the other thing, obviously, is there's a lot of video of you saying explaining what Afrofuturism. So, in some ways, when you're reading someone's definition versus you hearing them talk about it, like there's added information that's delivered because you hear their voice, you see their face, you see their body language, like they have hand gestures. All of that adds to a moment of clarity when people are trying to process information, right? So, even if I were to write out my lecture, which I never do, but if I were to write it out and give it to them, and then like give the same lecture, I guarantee you the students would be like, "I understood it better when you said it." And I'm like, "Okay, oh, it's just the
Right.
nature
It's
of the
like
beast,
reading Shakespeare versus watching the play.
right?" Yeah, like a lot of nuancey things are captured in that. And so, of course, obviously, for this thing, I want you to define Afrofuturism because I know that how much like, that you're asked to do that. But also, as you're doing it, maybe reflect on how you came to like understand, from your personal perspective to this more sort of instant, this is a movement. This is a, it's one thing to be a capitalist. It's another thing to like hear someone define it in a textbook, right? Like your everyday existence is now being codified by some external body with words that you may or may not agree with. And I'm just curious, like, for someone who's done so much, sometimes aware of the word Afrofuturism, sometimes not, but still doing the same things. How's that moment of arriving to a definition that you're trying to explain and share to the world? What does that feel like? How was that for you as a writer, as a thinker, as a practitioner?
Wow, these are great questions. I'm thinking, I think one of the definitions I resonated with the most when I first started kind of researching it was Alondra Nelson, because she emphasized liberation and the imagination and kind of her explanation of it. And I think, as I was looking to sort of craft a definition, it was, I think I'm thinking, again, it sounds, I'm thinking about the audience and what they understand, right? So, one of my definition, is, the first thing I usually say, it's about thinking about Afrofuturism is a way about thinking about a future or an alternate reality, but you're doing so through like a Black cultural lens. A lens is a visual. People understand if they're looking at something through like a lens that that's focusing, that's narrowing what's within their purview, right? It's just like, okay, thinking about a future and they're like alternate reality. Like, okay, well, that's like some kind of creative dream thing. People can get that. Then the next thing I say is that it can be an artistic aesthetic. And then I explain what that is, right? Like, you're looking at Janelle Monáe or Parliament Funkadelic, and these are names people are kind of familiar with. They know that imagery. They've seen these albums. They see what she looks like. They're like, okay, it's a look to it, kind of, and a vibe. But it's also a way of, It's also a way of thinking, you know, and it could be used as a form of kind of self-healing if because there's some people have issues with the imagination. And they're like, yeah, some people do have issues with the imagination and that they have a problem imagining things. And Afrofuturism can just help you with that, right? Then I say that all cultures have a relationship between space and time. Yeah, and just like, they do. And it's evident in, you know, how we might speak or dance and music. You know, these are articulations of space and time, beyond just how we measure it. And like, all right, that part gets a little deep. Usually I put that on the tail end. But the next thing that I usually say is that if you think about Afrofuturism, you think about a wheel. At the center of it is Black culture, right? And those intersecting spokes coming out of the wheel are imagination, liberation, technology, and mysticism. And mysticism is one that I added. There were other variations and definitions I saw before, and I didn't see mysticism added to it. And I sort of emphasized that because some of my initial conversations where I connected with people around the subject, even before we knew what the subject was around people thinking, either talking about spirituality or metaphysics as a lens, as a kind of grounding lens for them to think about futures. So anyway, so it's a well Black culture with the intersecting lines of imagination, liberation, technology, and mysticism. And then that's when I break down that all cultures have a relationship to space and time. You know, Black, African diaspora culture is no different, you know, and that perspective is going to shift based on where you are, whether you're in Chicago or Bahia or, you know, Dakar, Paris. Your relationship to space and time is going to be a little different, but these are complementary relationships as opposed to them being like opposites, right?
Gotcha.
So there's, yeah, so there's relationships there. And that's sort of my ground floor.
Right. And I think you do a great job of sort of getting at the root of your thinking there. I'm getting up on my time limit because these are always really intense when people are thinking about their own lives,
You're
going like, wait, what happened then?
like, who am I? Where am I?
But I always like to ask, finish up by asking people, is there something about their work that they want to be asked, but no one ever asks them?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I talk about dance a lot, but dance played a big role in how I thought about Afrofuturism and my like practical experiences with Afrofuturism because dance is an articulation of a relationship to space and time. You're creating movements within finite or open spaces, and you're doing so in on particular rhythms and patterns. And so to me, dance helps you to identify patterns and spot patterns, but it's very embodied, and navigate various dynamics. And so some of my experiences around Afrofuturism, in college or when I was, you know, really dancing or afterwards when I, you know, dance was when I was always going out of my way to make sure that I was dancing at these house music parties. There is like this sort of transcendence that can come from dancing. And some of this transcendence is an articulation or relationship to space and time, which really helped me think about Afrofuturism a little differently, I think, because I saw it as an embodied experience. I saw, in one sense, how, you know, so in the imaginative space, you're imagining a future, you experience that future to some extent because you're imagining it, right? And if you're open and receptive, you do something to kind of anchor that home or do some things to kind of bring that future about or make it real for you. dance is one of those ways for me, which I think has an art in a language that's not always articulated, where it could connect you with a kind of relationship to a future or Afrofuturism. And I think a lot of movements in Black dance are so unique, and they can unlock it can be our own joy generator. But it can also sort of be a space where you experience a dynamic of timelessness.
Oh, that's awesome. I like that. That's a great place to stop. A dynamic timelessness.
Yes, and then
All
it
right.
floats on. Yes,
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to tell me your story about being a writer and a thinker about Afrofuturism. I think, people look to you a lot in terms of Afrofuturism. But it's really helpful to hear your own origin story in terms of the thinking and practice around it. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk
no
to me.
problem. Yeah, next time you ask these questions, I'll give you a completely different origin story.